Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young. Coming up, why would Al-Qaeda target Arabs in Saudi America?
These are fantastic walled estates in which people can dress normally. Women run around in bikinis. These are people making $100,000 to $200,000 a year.
Also, lawyers help to fight. Lawyers fight to help school workers in the South get long overdue overtime pay.
The last time we didn't pay people for work done, we fought a war.
Veterans Day parades have trouble finding soldiers who haven't marched off to war.
And her supporters wonder why Shoshana Johnson got less media attention and less benefits than her comrade-in-arms, Jessica Lynch.
These stories and more, coming up here and now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. The Supreme Court has agreed to decide whether suspected al-Qaeda and Taliban fighters being held at the U.S. naval base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, should have access to U.S. courts. Lower courts have ruled that they should not. Michael Ratner is president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, which filed the petition with the High Court.
The two main arguments are, first, a court in the United States can take jurisdiction of these cases because the United States has ultimate jurisdiction and control of Guantanamo. And secondly, not only can a court hear it, but they can afford these people some right to a hearing as to whether or not they should be held.
Ratner says more than 600 foreign nationals are currently being held at Guantanamo. The Supreme Court has agreed to combine appeals from British, Australian, and Kuwaiti citizens and will hear them as a consolidated case next year. Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage says the al-Qaeda terrorist group is trying to topple the government of Saudi Arabia and bring down the Saudi royal family. Armitage is in Saudi Arabia and made that comment in a TV interview. The U.S. and Saudi governments are blaming al-Qaeda for the weekend car bombing at a housing complex in Riyadh that killed at least 17 people. The BBC's Bill Law says the attack was apparently well-planned.
They got right into the heart of the compound in spite of Interior Ministry assurances here that they hadn't penetrated very far, and that was cited as an example of how well security is working. The opposite was true. It was clear that they'd gotten right into the very core of the compound, and they exploded the bombs just where they wanted to, which would have maximum damage and maximum impact.
The BBC's Bill Law reporting. In Iraq today, a U.S. military police officer was killed in a grenade attack south of Baghdad. Massachusetts Senator John Kerry has shaken up his campaign staff in an effort to revive his bid for the Democratic presidential nomination. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Kerry was once considered by many Democratic insiders to be a very strong candidate for the nomination. He had an edge in New Hampshire because he was from Massachusetts. He had a big campaign war chest and a large crew of experienced operatives. He also had a resume with a military record that he claimed made him the most electable candidate. But former Vermont Governor Howard Dean has roared past Kerry in the polls in New Hampshire, and Kerry has been criticized by many Democratic officials for being too cautious and for failing to develop a compelling message to drive voters to his campaign. So today, Kerry released a statement saying that campaign manager Jim Jordan is out and will be replaced by Mary Beth Cahill, currently the chief of staff for Massachusetts Senator Edward Kennedy. Earlier, Communications Director Chris Lehane also decided to leave the Kerry campaign. Mara Liasson, NPR News, Washington.
Washington, D.C. area sniper suspect Lee Boyd Malvo has pleaded innocent to murder charges at the start of his trial for one of the sniper killings. Defense attorneys are hoping to convince the jury the 18-year-old is innocent by reason of insanity. Wall Street, the Dow is down 50 points in light trading. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, stocks have retreated a bit in early trading today. There's little in the way of economic news thus far to push the market in either direction. Blue chips hit a 17-month high last Friday, and the NASDAQ was at a 22-month high as the Labor Department reported positive employment numbers. The World Trade Organization has upheld a decision that U.S. duties on imported steel violate international trade rules. Douglas Baxton has more from Luxembourg City.
In a final verdict, the WTO's appellate body has confirmed a decision of a panel of trade judges that the tariffs are inconsistent with trading regulations. This means President Bush must quickly withdraw the tariffs or face retaliation from the European Union, which has threatened to hit back with over $2 billion in duties on American goods. The tariffs were imposed in March of 2002 and were originally up to 30%, but later lowered. Washington says they are needed to protect the struggling U.S. steel industry. However, the WTO judges earlier found that Washington failed to prove its industry is under real threat from the EU, Japan, China, Brazil, and other steel producers. For NPR News, I'm Douglas Baxton in Luxembourg City.
Another mutual fund firm is shaking up top management as it faces scrutiny over trading practices. Alliance Capital Holding has fired two top executives who had oversight over the company's mutual fund unit. The firm has also announced there's a high likelihood it will face sanctions and penalties connected with allowing market timing trading by big investors. Also today, Merrill Lynch has reportedly fined two managers who were responsible for brokers the firm recently fired for making improper mutual fund trades. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, helping disadvantaged children and their families connect to strong and supportive neighborhoods. On the web at aecf.org.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
In its war against the West and regimes supported by the West like Saudi Arabia, why would al-Qaeda kill fellow Arabs? In its attack on a housing complex in the capital Riyadh this weekend, all of the 17 dead are believed to be non-Saudi Arabs, including women and children. Youssef Ibrahim is managing director for Strategic Energy Investment Group. He joins us from Dubai. Welcome, Youssef.
Good evening.
Youssef, thanks for joining us. You had spent 15 days in Riyadh, Youssef, before the attack. You'd just gotten on a plane when the actual attack happened. What's your sense of why Arabs would be attacked, not Westerners?
Well, it's not so much a question of attacking Arabs. This particular complex used to be, by the way, the Boeing staff complex. Mm. And it so happens that the Boeing people left it some time ago, obviously, that intelligence may not have gotten to the terrorists. But regardless of this issue, what al-Qaeda is going for here is, after scaring the hell out of the Western American, English, French, et cetera, super managers who run the Saudi economy, they are going for the managerial class that is running the Saudi economy. You have to remember, what are these complexes? These are, I was in one of them that same night, fantastic walled estates in which people can dress normally, women run around in bikinis, there's a swimming pool shared by every four villas. These are people making $100,000 to $200,000 a year. Mm-hmm. They are running airlines, they are running electricity shops. They may be Arabs, they may be Indian, but they're essentially Lebanese and Moroccans. And this is the managerial crest that makes the Saudi economy run.
Youssef, what's your sense? I'm sure in those 15 days you just spent in Saudi Arabia, you spent a lot of time socializing with people. What's your sense of average Saudi's attitude toward al-Qaeda?
The average Saudi attitude is very mixed, and it resembles much the rest of the Arab and beyond that, the Muslim attitude. There is a new paradigm in the region. This new paradigm has come from two factors: the deep dissatisfaction with the living conditions, the corruption, the fact that bureaucracy never gets anything done, but also there is this incredible antipathy towards the Bush administration, and they would very much like to see the United States get a black eye wherever. For example, in Iraq, they wouldn't want Saddam Hussein to come back, but they'd like the United States to really get a beating in there. And the two have come together to leave people in a situation where they say, you know, like Samson, let that temple come on top of everybody's head, which is a very sinister mood. But that's basically,
and there's more,
what you have is an explosive mix.
An explosive mix, including, we hear last week, of running gun battles in Mecca.
I was there when there was, in fact, a three-day running gun battle. And then I'll tell you something.
Between Saudi security or army and Al-Qaeda?
Saudi security, and what Saudi security said was Al-Qaeda elements that they were tracking down.
So does this imperil the Saudi regime on any level? Or?
Well, it does. I mean, the Saudi regime is founded on two levels, on two pillars. The two pillars are that we have given you prosperity and we have given you security. In return for this, we rule. The prosperity has pretty much evaporated over the past 2 years. Now there goes security, and that's very important. For example, this is amazing that this attack has happened. And 2 days before, I was visiting Al-Hamra complex, which was bombed in May. It took me almost half an hour to get to the main door of Al-Hamra because it's all now festooned, peppered with these huge cement obstacles, and the cars have to turn round and round and round and round to get to the main door, that they could get to a complex, this complex, which is equally well protected, means this is a big attack. And it also means another thing. It is possible that Al-Qaeda inside Saudi Arabia has morphed and grown, and that the number of dormant cells are far bigger than anything the Saudi or the American CIA intelligence system estimated.
Youssef Ibrahim, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Youssef Ibrahim is a former journalist and now managing director for Strategic Energy Investment Group. Individual investors have already pulled a record $4.5 billion out of Putnam Investments following charges of mismanagement at that firm. Institutional investors, including pension plans in Vermont, Rhode Island, and Pennsylvania, have pulled an additional $4.5 billion from Putnam, too. Joining us to discuss where the money's going and Putnam's future and what it means for the larger mutual fund industry is Kunal Kapoor, Associate Director of Mutual Fund Analysis at Morningstar Incorporated. Welcome.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us. We should point out first that Putnam's strongly denied any wrongdoing in all this, but analysts say the $4.5 billion in individual investments pulled is just the tip of the iceberg. Can Putnam survive this?
Absolutely. You know, I think they can certainly survive it. I think in the short term, there are clearly some issues that they'll have to go through, but one thing to remember is that, you know, a rising market and good performance can solve a lot of ills, and I think that's what, you know, Putnam is basically going to be counting on.
I mean, this is the fifth largest fund complex by assets with a total of $272 billion in mutual funds. So $4 or $5 or $10 or $20 billion here or there doesn't really matter.
Exactly. And you know, clearly, if the market rises 5 or 10%, you know, that clearly makes up for any shortfall in assets in terms of money leaving.
Now, what about nervous investors out there who are also looking at mutual funds like Janus and Strong? Now, neither firm has been charged with anything yet, but there's word that they could be.
Right.
How nervous is it making mutual fund investors, and should they be?
Well, you know, the upshot of, you know, being a mutual fund investor is that, you know, you don't have to react in a hurried manner like you would, you know, with a stock where a piece of news can, you know, very significantly impact the value of your investment. However, what I will say here is if this episode has taught investors anything, you know, it's the notion that you really need to look beyond just the returns before you buy a mutual fund. You need to look at the, you know, who's running the fund? How do they invest their own money? Is the fund family, you know, fairly forthright in its communications with shareholders? And things like that, you know, very tangible signs that you're getting a company that really looks out for you.
You got to do your homework, I guess. But an awful lot of mutual fund investors, I suspect, are awfully busy people who don't have time to do their homework.
Right. And I think that that's a great point. But at the end of the day, you know, what I will point out is, you know, we spend more time, you know, worrying about things like our cable bill and things like that. But very few of us probably know what we pay for our mutual funds because we don't have to write them a check every year.
Yeah.
So, you know, it certainly maybe does take some time, but I think the decision is important enough and can have such a meaningful impact on your future that, you know, 10, 15 minutes on a weekend will probably, you know, suffice.
Are people pulling money from Putnam, putting it somewhere else?
Yeah, absolutely. I would imagine that's the case, especially since Putnam, you know, gets most of its sales through advisors. I would imagine those folks are just rebalancing into other fund families. And interestingly enough, a lot of the money off late has been going, you know, to lower cost fund families like the American Funds, the Vanguards, and the Fidelities of this world, which maybe is a hint that, you know, the investors are basically finding the good fund families.
Kunal Kapoor is Associate Director of Mutual Fund Analysis at the investment research firm Morningstar Incorporated. Thanks a lot, Mr. Kapoor.
Thanks.
Tomorrow should be an especially significant Veterans Day, what with so many active U.S. troops deployed overseas. But the irony is that in a year when so many Americans want to honor soldiers, there may not be enough of them to go around. The U.S. has a reported 131,600 troops and an untold number of tanks deployed in Iraq. The army is said to be stretched so thin that even the old guard, the soldiers who stand vigil at the tomb of the unknown soldier, will soon be deployed abroad for the first time since the Vietnam War. So many Veterans Day parades have been scaled back or canceled, with some cities calling in on the Boy Scouts to fill in the gap. Russ Geyer is an Army veteran. He heads the parade committee in Miami Lakes, Florida. And Russ, you had a preview of what some others might face tomorrow. You had your Veterans Day parade yesterday?
Yes, we did.
And what happened?
It was a gorgeous day. We had a record turnout, and it was a great success.
Did you see, though, what other cities are anticipating, that you might have had the record turnout and maybe of veterans, but not of active soldiers?
That's correct. We had anticipated return of a lot of our people from the National Guard and the reserves that were sent over there. They didn't come back, of course.
Did you get any returning soldiers at all?
We did get a few. In fact, it was wonderful that we received two or three the evening of the parade. Mm. And we hustled them right out there, put them in onto floats and in cars. And we were so thrilled to get them that the absence of the others was mooted.
Yeah. But, you know, in some towns, I'm sure you've heard, for instance, outside San Jose, a lot of smaller towns are going to join San Jose's parade because they can't put together their own. At Fort Riley in Kansas, the bases had to turn down invitations from towns that want the troops to participate because they just don't have the troops. They've been deployed. How many people did you get turning out?
Well, I would say there, in terms of participating in the parade, it was over 1,000.
And how many watching?
Probably 2,000 to 3,000.
Yeah. And how does that compare to past years?
Oh, it's much better, much higher.
But as you say, for you, it would have been nice if your troops were there, but you're going to do it anyway.
It didn't affect our attendance. I think it helped because we're just there to honor.
I wonder, too, we've done stories in past years about the other problem that is increasingly occurring on Veterans Day, is that the veterans themselves are dying off. Those who are still living from World War II, there's just fewer and fewer of them.
Absolutely. Now, the community did have, at one time, a number of World War II veterans. One of them was our Grand Marshal last year. And even since then, his health has deteriorated. It is a problem, no question about it.
The old veterans are dying off, and the younger ones are at war.
That's about it.
Russ, you hear one of the themes underlying this, that people worry that the troops are just getting stretched too thin, that there aren't enough people, not just for the parades, obviously, but for all the needs overseas.
The fact that they're having to stay as long as they are, and South Florida is sending more Guard and Reserve units probably than any other state. And we miss those people, but we certainly recognize the job they have to do, and it's a tough one.
Yeah. Well, Russ Geyer, thank you.
You're more than welcome.
Russ Geyer, an Army veteran. He heads the parade committee in Miami Lakes, Florida. They held their Veterans Day parade yesterday.
Just ahead, school workers in the South force cash-strapped schools to cough up overtime pay.
And later in the program, two soldiers, one black, one white. One gets a movie and a book deal. The other, we'll find out in our D.C. roundtable.
There's more coming up here and now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
School districts struggling with budget deficits are also facing lawsuits from former janitors, cooks, and bus drivers suing for overtime pay. The School Litigation Group, a law firm in Jackson, Mississippi, has specialized in seeking unpaid overtime on behalf of school employees. Their website promises to help school workers get the money you deserve. But school officials say the lawsuits have forced them to eliminate teaching jobs and new school buses, and perhaps ironically, the jobs of the workers seeking the back overtime pay. Attorney Samuel Brand is the founder of the School Litigation Group. He joins us on the line from Jackson, Mississippi. Hello.
How are you doing?
I'm fine. Well, let's start with how this works. Since many of these schools don't have punch clocks and since some of these claims go back over years, how do you figure out how much a worker is owed?
Well, under the Fair Labor Standards Act, the record-keeping responsibility is on the employer, not the employee. And you can only go back 2 years from the date of the filing of the lawsuit, 3 years if it's intentional. So if a school employee, let's say, has been there 15 years and has been working overtime for 15 years, under the best case scenario, they would be able to collect for 3 years. Under normal, it would be a 2 year period. And you, if there are no records, you have to estimate and listen to what the people are telling you and telling you the hours they're working and just, it's a mathematical computation. You're not building rockets.
Yeah, well, you know, Sam, some would say, you just mentioned that it might go back 15 years that somebody worked overtime without pay. And someone listening might say, well, that's their fault. I mean, if they went for years and years without either questioning or acting to get their overtime, aren't they sort of volunteering at that point?
No. In fact, in a lot of the instances, they have been told by school officials that they are either salaried and not entitled to overtime, or that it doesn't matter if they work overtime, they're not going to pay them. And yet in the majority of the schools, they've got posters posted that the Department of Labor requires. So a large part of these people are uneducated, underpaid. They're some of the poorest people on the socioeconomic ladder of anybody you'll run across.
Well, the schools are saying, as you well know, that one superintendent is quoted as saying, he got caught with his pants down, that this is something they just hadn't kept track of. And now they're forced to install a $50,000 time clock system, pay sometimes hundreds of thousands of dollars in settlements, and that it's breaking the back of the schools.
Well, I realize it may be, it would probably hurt the schools financially, but that's not the issue. And that's an issue the superintendents like to use. And, of course, I have no sympathy because they're drawing the relatively large salary, $100,000 plus, and the guy driving the school bus making $6 an hour. The question becomes, is do they owe the employees? If the employees have done the work, then they should be paid for it. Mm-hmm. The last time we didn't pay people for work done, we fought a war. And I hope we're not, and the schools are not advocating that these individuals should not be paid for what they've done. They're not holding their hand out. They've already performed the work. They're owed the money. So the question becomes, does the schools have a moral obligation to pay their employees?
None of these cases have gone to court, am I right? They've all been settled out of court?
In Mississippi, we settled, we filed 102 lawsuits. We had approximately 6,000 plaintiffs. About 4,200 had claims, and they were all settled, yes.
Yeah. And do we understand that your fees can be as much as 50% of the funds recovered?
It can be, yes, because what the employee's entitled to is an amount equal to the back wages owed, which is called liquidated damages. And we have found that the schools, when the and that's the norm. If you go into court, the norm is that you will get your back wages plus an amount equal to it. So when we originally started, because of the cost and the labor intensity of what we're doing, we got the employees the back wages they were owed, and then in some cases we got the liquidated damages. In some cases we didn't. We had to look at it on a individual deal. The total cost of the litigation in Mississippi was close to $1 million.
I mentioned some of the job categories, but could you tell us as well, who are some of these workers that you're talking about?
Well, a dual employee drives a bus and is a teacher's aide, drives a bus and an assistant coach, a custodian who's also an assistant coach. You've got all types of dual employees. Then you've got just plain custodians, cafeteria workers, cafeteria managers, maintenance individuals, bus drivers.
Do you think that this is mostly, this is a bigger problem in the South than elsewhere because most of your clients have been in the South?
Yeah, probably so. I know that that the industrialized North, Northeastern up there has unions that represent the individuals, and we have spoken with some of the union janitors and people in, for example, New York and Pennsylvania, and they're very frank to say, oh, no, the union, if we work over 40, we get overtime, and if we work on Saturday, we get double time. So that's a real disparity when you look at how it's treated in one area of the country where they have somebody to represent these individuals, and the other areas of the country where they have nobody to represent them other than some lawyers.
Well, Samuel Brand, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Samuel Brand is one of those lawyers. He's founder of the School Litigation Group.
A watershed election in Japan Sunday. For the first time, voters had a viable opposition party and candidates to choose from. The ruling coalition did end up keeping control of the government, but it wasn't the big win Prime Minister Junichiro Koizumi hoped for, signaling new pressure for reform in the long, stagnant second-largest economy in the world. WBUR producer John Marston talked to some Japanese voters about their concerns on Election Day.
One of the most important issues facing among us is that the sending the army, Japanese army, to Iraq. Also, we're concerned about the North Korea's policy, what they have been recently doing to us.
That dictator Kim Jong-il must disappear in politics scene.
I just hope, like, the economy will be better.
Korean government.
I'm come to election because it's a duty. It's the only duty. But whoever elected, nothing can change in Japan.
Thoughts of Japanese voters at the polls this past weekend.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, on Veterans Day, we honor some of the newest veterans, those returning from the front in Iraq.
And the storied career and stormy life of Sammy Davis Jr.
That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. Thank you.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, a perception in the African-American community that Shoshana Johnson, caught in the same ambush with Jessica Lynch, isn't getting her fair share of attention or money.
Private Johnson's on track right now to receive a 30% disability benefit. Private Lynch is on track to receive an 80% disability.
And low-tech folk music benefits from high-tech downloading.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Steve Brown. The Supreme Court is going to hear its first cases dealing with the government's post-9/11 anti-terrorism campaign. The justices will be hearing court challenges involving foreign prisoners held at a military prison in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. The issue is whether the prisoners should be given access to American courts. Anne Guerin reports.
They will hear a case that asks whether these men have access to United States courts, which sounds like it's sort of a prosaic question, but it's really a very important one. If they have access to United States courts, then they can bring major constitutional challenges and legal challenges to their detention and continued detention without trial.
The appeals come from British, Australian, and Kuwaiti citizens. Like hundreds of others, they're suspected of working for the Taliban or Al-Qaeda. In another case, the Supreme Court has refused to consider an appeal filed by an Islamic charity whose assets were frozen 3 months after 9/11. The Global Relief Foundation says the U.S. government put it out of business without any proof it was funneling money to terrorists. The government claims it found evidence linking the company to Osama bin Laden's former personal secretary. The U.S. Embassy in Saudi Arabia is today easing some restrictions placed on its staff and families. The move comes just 2 days after a deadly attack that left at least 17 people dead. After reviewing the daily threat level, the U.S. Embassy decided staff and their families can now travel outside the diplomatic quarter. The embassy itself, however, will remain closed indefinitely. The Secret Service plans to question the pilot of a small plane that strayed too close to the White House today. The privately owned plane was intercepted by Air Force fighter jets, which escorted it away from the area. At the time, President Bush was away, but Vice President Dick Cheney and White House Chief of Staff Andrew Card were moved temporarily as a precaution. Trial is underway in Virginia for the second Washington-area sniper suspect. 18-year-old Lee Malvo entered pleas of not guilty to charges of murder and terrorism. In his trial, Malvo is accused of shooting to death FBI analyst Linda Franklin. The judge refused a defense motion to dismiss the terrorism charge. Jury selection is now taking place. On Wall Street at midday, stocks are down. The Dow is down 47 points at 97.62. The NASDAQ is down 18 points at 19.53. And the S&P 500 is down 5 points at 10.48. It's 33 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Here and Now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
With just 11 weeks to go before New Hampshire's first-in-the-nation primary, an uneasy ripple passes through two campaigns. Democratic presidential candidate Senator John Kerry, behind in the polls, has fired his campaign manager. And a new Newsweek poll shows that while President Bush is gaining support on his handling of the economy, voters increasingly think the war in Iraq is not going so well. Joining us on the line are members of our D.C. roundtable. Andrea Stone covers Congress for USA Today. Hi, Andrea.
Hi, Robin.
And Bill Douglas covers the White House for Knight Ridder Newspapers. Hello, Bill.
Hi.
Andrea, to you first. So Kerry fires a campaign manager. Howard Dean will pick up two major union endorsements this week and drops campaign public financing. What does it all mean?
It all means that Howard Dean is starting to pull away. At least that's what all the pundits are starting to say. John Kerry has just not gotten any traction in this campaign. You know, at one point, people were saying he was going to be the front runner or very near the top. He's just not there in the polls.
Behind in double digits to Dean in New Hampshire,
right,
in Kerry's backyard.
Exactly. I mean, if he can't win in New Hampshire, you know, just forget about it. So he, you know, he's having to shake up his campaign, which is not the first time he shook up his campaign. You know, and now he's saying that he's prepared to follow Dean in turning down public financing, which is something that a lot of the other candidates can't afford to do. I mean, basically, you know, the lid is off on limiting how much he spends. And, you know, this financing law came about after the Watergate scandal, and everybody has been adhering to it since then. But President Bush, who has no opposition in the primaries, that doesn't have a primary, he's going to raise an estimated $200 million for his primary. So I think the Democrats see the handwriting on the wall, and they say, look, we've got to spend. If we can raise it, we have to spend it.
And your paper is reporting that he is going to forego the public financing.
He's
and
getting
and,
ready, yeah.
And has a lot of personal wealth to back up his foregoing them.
He does. His wife is Teresa Hines Kerry, who's the widow of John Hines and the Hines ketchup fortune. So he can use his wife's money to stay in the race.
Well, Bill, turning to you, the president is in South Carolina fundraising today. The Newsweek poll shows his lead against Democrats slipping. The other factor is coming up. People will vote for someone other than President Bush. What are you hearing?
Well, people at the White House are a little concerned. I mean, for them, it's still early. They got some good news last week on the economy, though there's still a question about jobs growth. The real problem is the war. The public support for the war is not as firm as what it was. And it's an issue that the Bush administration, for better or for worse, intends to hang its hat on during the reelection campaign.
Well, Andrea, paint the picture in Congress for the week coming up. The November 21st recess looms, but then there's this sort of, what would you call it?
Debate. Floor time.
Scheduled for Wednesday. Tell us about that.
The Republicans are planning to spend 30 hours of their dwindling time basically talking about how the Democrats have held up four of Bush's judicial nominees. And, you know, this is a time when they're trying to get a Medicare prescription drug bill, they're trying to get an energy bill, they're trying to pass spending bills. You know, some Democrats are wondering if this is really the best use of their time, but the Republicans are really mad about some of these judicial nominations that have been held up by the Democrats, who say that some of these judges are just too conservative.
And how is this going to affect the already bad feelings and the possibility of passing any of this legislation?
The closer we get to recess, the nastier it seems to get. You know, the Democrats are very angry at the Republicans, who have cut them out of conference committees. You know, when the House and the Senate pass bills and they're different, they have to go into a conference to make them match. And even though Democrats have been named to conference committees, they've really been locked out. Charlie Rangel of New York, who's on the Medicare conference, he says he can't even get in the room.
Well, Bill, paint the global picture for us in a way, if you will. The president's big speech on spreading democracy around the world didn't get a lot of play here in the U.S., but it caused a lot of reaction in the Middle East. What do you hear?
That's pretty accurate. It made some people overseas nervous, particularly in the Middle East. Countries don't like other countries deciding their fates.
And I think also it's particular in the Arab world. They don't. The Arab world doesn't really trust the United States. They think that they're, you know, an ally of Israel on every issue. So there's a real mistrust and almost a paranoia over there about what are the actual motives. And I want to just mention another thing. It seemed that when he was starting to talk about democracy, the president was trying to change the subject from the war on terror to making what we're doing over in Iraq and in that region democratization, and which is, you know, the war on terror is not going so well, so let's talk about something else.
Well, before we let you both go, I want to talk to you, Bill, about an article you wrote about Jessica Lynch and her soldier comrade Shoshana Johnson, a black woman who was in the same convoy that was attacked, fought her way out, was taken hostage, but some say isn't getting near the media attention or near the benefits that Jessica Lynch is getting. Tell us about it.
I just was going through my email this morning, and this is the most email I've received on any article I've ever written. There's a perception in the African-American community that Shoshana Johnson has not gotten her just due in terms of attention and in terms of benefits. There was always this initial feeling that she didn't get the attention, and then when word came out that she was getting fewer benefits than Jessica Lynch, that sort of reinforced it within the African-American community.
Compare the benefits for us.
Private Johnson's on track right now to receive a 30% disability benefit. Private Lynch is on track to receive an 80% disability.
Why?
The military says they have a formula based on extent of injuries, expected lifestyle, and employment potential post-military. And a review board does this, and they determine that Private Johnson should receive 30%. Private Johnson is going to appeal that determination from the military.
Right. The irony is that Jessica Lynch supports her comrade, says she should be getting much more of the benefits, and that, in fact, Shoshana Johnson's the one who fought her way.
Correct. Jessica Lynch has said that Shoshana Johnson is a true hero. The Army says their issue is not one of black and white, but of apples and oranges when comparing the level of benefits. Johnson is on track to be discharged from the military because her injuries are permanent. Jessica Lynch has been put in a temporary disabled category for the time being.
Do you think there'll be any change here?
Possibly. With the temporary status, Lynch can be her condition can be reevaluated periodically, so her benefits could go down.
I want to thank you both.
It's been great.
Thank you.
Bill Douglas, White House correspondent for Knight Ridder Newspapers. Andrea Stone, congressional correspondent for USA Today, members of our D.C. roundtable.
You're listening to Here and Now. College tuition continues to rise steadily, but there are a handful of schools which help with financial aid much more than others. U.S. News & World Report just published new data of the most affordable colleges from 2002 to 2003, and joining us to discuss that is Anne McGrath, who's editor of the U.S. News Ultimate College Directory 2004. Welcome, Anne.
Hi, thank you.
Thanks for joining us. So, Anne, the theme of your list seems to be that some colleges are looking more closely at that crunched middle class, the people who are neither rich nor poor. The poor can get a lot of scholarship. The rich don't need the scholarship. And that's what seems to be the difference, whether a college is concentrating on that group or not.
Right. I think that's really true, that schools are very concerned that when they accept students who are qualified, that they make it possible for the family to actually come, that they're as careful about that as they can possibly be. I think that often families worry and won't even consider the most expensive schools because they just assume that those schools are going to be beyond them financially, when in fact, often the most expensive private institutions may, to academically qualified students, may actually end up being less expensive than some of the state institutions that don't have as generous financial aid budgets to work with. And many colleges, even if they don't have huge endowments, have made it a number one priority to make sure that their financial aid budgets are as large as they can possibly make them.
Well, give me a list, and inevitably will have to be an incomplete list, but give me a list of the most affordable colleges slash the most generous colleges out there.
Well, if you look at our list based simply on the size of the average amount of financial aid, the schools that are in the top 10 among national universities include George Washington University, Vanderbilt, Dartmouth, Stanford, Cornell, Harvard, Yale, and Penn, Columbia, Johns Hopkins. Princeton is on that list also, and it's unusual among schools in that it doesn't require families to take out loans. Mm-hmm. Really, in that sense, Princeton's probably the most generous. And because another thing that families also have to look at when they're judging the size of the financial aid package is how much of it is actually gift money and how much of it needs to be repaid.
Well, you know, that's one thing one notes. Oddly enough, Wesleyan and Middlebury, which give the most aid, both made the top eight for students who leave with the largest amount of debt. How does that work?
Well, often colleges have the ability to come up with a round number, a figure for a total aid package, and then they have to decide how much of that money they're going to give outright as a scholarship or a grant, how much of that money they're going to loan the family, and how much of that will come in the form of work study so that the student takes a job on campus and collects a paycheck as part of his aid package. So the total number is key relative to the total cost, but you also have to look very carefully when you're comparing your aid packages at the amounts that come in the form of grants and the amounts that come in the form of loans.
These elite schools, hard as they are to get into, are also compete for the best students. What's the impact been, and if any, on how a school draws the best students because of their financial aid packages?
In general, there has been a real trend toward offering so-called merit scholarships to very attractive students. Students who have high academic credentials, whose SAT scores are high, and who are talented maybe in musically or in drama, who have some sort of special talent.
Anne McGrath, senior writer at U.S. News and World Report. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Well, folk music and the technological cutting edge may not seem to be a natural fit, but MP3s, file sharing, and downloading are only the latest innovations folk music has weathered. Heck, low-tech folk has survived newfangled gizmos before. Take, for example, the microphone. We're joined now in the studio by our folk music critic, Scott Alaric, who says music downloading may be boosting folk. Welcome, Scott.
Great to be here, Bill.
Scott, the music industry is 16% smaller than in 2000. That's a lot. Mm-hmm. The industry says it's because of downloading. But as a folk music lover and aficionado, you say maybe up with all the downloading, the freeloading?
Well, it does seem to be helping folk music, Bill, and a lot of alternative music forms. I think maybe because folk music is used to taking the long view of things. You know, this is a music form that's willing to wait 200 or 300 years to make up its mind if a song is a keeper, you know. So we tend to look back whenever we're not sure where we're going, to look back at where we've been. And if you look back, you can see that we actually have gone down these kinds of roads before. And one of the things that folk music has learned very well over the years is that progress is a bully and change is a bully. There are casualties. along the way. You know, a very similar thing happened when electricity revolutionized human culture and music at the turn of the 20th century. With the coming of records and then radio, you heard a lot of the same kinds of things coming from people. This is going to destroy live music. This is going to destroy music the way we've always had it. And they were right. They were right. It did. It changed everything. You take examples that we just take for granted today, like the microphone. Before the microphone came along, singers like Al Jolson were considered torch singers. They were praised for the intimacy of their approach. Then when the microphone allowed people to sing in a normal speaking voice and to carry the sound, new guys like Bing Crosby came along, and they were called crooners because of their ability to almost whisper as they sang. Suddenly a guy like Al Jolson with his nah seemed very bombastic and old-fashioned, and it took him 20, 30 years to get his career back on track. When movies learned how to talk, it destroyed vaudeville. Tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of careers were destroyed. And not just careers, but whole professions in entertainment. Animal acts, ventriloquists, contortionists, reciters of classic poetry and prose. Hundreds of thousands of people thrown out of work.
Well, Scott, do you have any examples of how folk music has transformed itself before?
Yeah, let me stick with the microphone example here and give you an idea of how Irish music sounded before they were able to amplify it. In the 1920s, Irish music was a real craze. There were a lot of Irish musicians that were forming sort of jazz bands and becoming extremely popular. But to be heard without amplification in these huge halls over thousands of clogging feet, their playing had to be very muscular. Listen to this, one of the best and the most successful of them, Dan Sullivan's Shamrock Band from Boston, enormously popular in the 20s. Now listen to how strong their attack is. And the use of trills, which is to many the signature of Irish music, only included if they're part of the melody structure. There's no embellishment, and everyone is playing in this forceful unison, no counter melodies, counterpoint, or even harmony. Great music.
Very kind of a raw sound to it. Is that what you're getting at?
Well, it's a very, very forceful song. And these guys, just like Jolson, when PA systems came in and people could play softly through microphones, this sound just seemed so old-fashioned and hackneyed. And all of these really skilled musicians were out of work. And by the 1940s, this entire style of music was out of fashion. And instrumental Irish traditional music was barely heard at all on records or on radio until it was reinvented in the 1970s using modern pop ensemble arrangement ideas and called Celtic music. Now, let's listen to something from today. This is how an Irish reel is played today by the state-of-the-art Celtic band Sullis. Listen to the dynamic range and how different the fiddle and accordion parts are and the rhythm sections underneath, how much is going on.
Dan Sullivan of the Shamrock Band have made of that.
I don't know. I think they would have loved the opportunity to be able to play like that, because I'm sure it was hard work to be able to play the way Dan Sullivan's band did.
So, Scott, with all the change around downloading, how's that affecting folk music right now in 2003?
Everything I hear is that it's helping. Because folk music is still primarily a performance medium, the idea is to get people out to the shows, and because it's so seldom heard through commercial media, anything that gets the word out.
Yeah.
Christine Lavin, one of the most successful folk headliners on the circuit today, calls MP3 downloads fan seeds. Huh. And I also recently talked to Chris Smither, who's having the best part of his career with his great new album. And he said he's constantly getting people at his shows saying, coming up to him and saying, you know, I downloaded a few of your songs, and now I'm here, and I want everything. And then they go and they buy all of the CDs. But there's something deeper and more elemental going on here, I think, how folk artists are using these new technologies to return to the most basic roots of what folk music is as a social music.
And which was sharing the music in a community.
Absolutely. And the idea of folk as a social music, kind of the self-made soundtrack to people's lives. There's a guy named John McCutcheon, a great songwriter and Appalachian folk musician. He was so quick to the internet that his website is folkmusic.com. He was right at the front of the
line.
Cutting
edge folky.
And he's benefiting from it tremendously. He loves to write topical songs. So one of the problems of the recording technology is a lot of times by the time you get ready for your next record, the topical song is dated. So he puts them up on his website, and which goes back to one of the most ancient traditions of folk music called broadsides, where people used to write lyrics on penny sheets called broadsides and go out and sell them so they'd have the new song out, the satire out the next day. So McCutcheon's doing that on his website. Here's a song that he wrote that's getting downloaded a lot. You might remember when Attorney General Ashcroft told us that it was all up to us to sort of snoop on everybody and snoop on our neighbors and find out who's American and who's un-American. Here he brilliantly ties this to this wider theme of you're not a patriot if you don't agree with us.
I want to be in Ashcroft's army. I want to be a mole. It's time to show the rest of my neighbors just who's in control. The vice president said, shame on you. The attorney general said it too. Don't you criticize what we do. I want to be a spy.
It gets to be about a real conversation between the artist and the community listening to the artist.
You're absolutely right. Getting back to this idea of folk as a social music, real people using songs to explore their lives together. And there's another example of Roger McGuinn of the Byrds, and he ought to know about new technologies changing things. He's the guy who all but invented folk rock in the 1960s. And he recently made a deal with MP3.com for an ongoing series of songs. He calls it Live from the Folk Den. And he's returning to the most intimate social roots of folk music, traveling around with his digital recorder like Johnny Appleseed, getting together with folk singing friends and sharing the results through the internet in a very stripped down acoustic way. Here he's just sitting around in Judy Collins' living room, swapping tunes the way they've done for 40 years, singing a song they both famously recorded in the 60s, but never together. And now, thanks to all this newfangled, gimcrack, doodad technology, we get to listen in. Cyberspace has taken music right back to the front parlor.
There a young maid, all in her garden, strange young man, come riding by. Sin there, young maid, will you marry me? And this dear sir,
that's really beautiful, Scott, and reminds me right away of when so many of these artists first came up in the 60s. The recordings were very unproduced. There was a tremendous naturalness, and the internet does seem like a natural medium for people to be able to share these kind of intimate sessions.
It's real people making real music for real people, and the easier the technology makes that, the better news it is for music like folk music.
So as high-tech as this all is, it may actually make a way for artists to be more low-tech.
The tools may be a change, but the people and the songs remain the same.
That's what it's always about. Yeah. Scott Alaric, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks, Bill. Always a pleasure.
Scott Alaric is here in Now's Folk Music Critic.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
And join us again. Here and Now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news and these stories, Here and Now.
On Veterans Day, we honor some of the newest veterans, those returning from the front in Iraq.
And the storied career and stormy life of Sammy Davis Jr.
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.